Hey guys, Harrison Wan back at it once again with a brand new podcast for you, and welcome back to Motorsport 101. I've already lost count of how many episodes we've done by now. I think this is 15, or 13, or 15 or 14, I can't remember for sure, don't really care. It's been a very, very busy weekend in the world of motorsport, we've got a lot to cover in this episode. But first, before I really get going, I just want to mention as well, and obviously this episode is dedicated to the fan that tragically lost his life at the Nürburgring this past weekend. It was obviously just a freak accident. Jan Mardenborough's GT3 Skyline flying literally into the stands, and Jan was okay, but several fans were injured, and fortunately one fan succumbed to his injuries, and obviously just a complete tragedy. And my thoughts and condolences to the family involved, and this is just a stark reminder of just how dangerous and still motorsport can be. I think it's something we very much take for granted still. As fans, you know, you think in 2015 that, you know, everything's going to be okay when you see a big wreck, and sometimes things like this still happen. So, again, like I said, thoughts and condolences with the family involved as well. And with Jan, of course, because, you know, that must be pretty traumatic to have to go through, knowing that you were, you know, the victim of that, and not only that, but obviously a fan passing away as well. We have a guest again, and with me this time, making his first appearance in 5 episodes. he did 10 straight, then he's missed the last 3 or 4, which is amazing. It's Ryan King, everybody. Welcome back, sir.
Yeah, it's great to be back. It's like, hopefully I don't miss, like, the next 10 and end up being like Dwayne Wade.
You had your one moment of greatness there, King. Now live for the next 9 years of mediocrity like Dwayne Wade did. No, I'm joking. But good to have you back, sir. It's been a while. Unfortunately, the Kraken is not with us. He's too busy spending the next 16 hours a day editing the AOR Pro Mazda series. Poor guy.
Bless his poor soul.
Bless his poor soul. Like I said, it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it. But he'll be back very soon, I'm sure. He loves the show, and he loves taking the piss out of me for it. So he'll be back soon enough. Like we mentioned when our last episode, when you weren't here, he's here in spirit. I'm sure. But on this absolutely stacked edition of Motorsport 101, an enormous triple header of motorsport this weekend. We have the Formula One Malaysian Grand Prix to review, and shock horror, for the first time in 10 races, a Merckx didn't win. And for the first time in 35 races, a Ferrari won. Sebastian Vettel taking his 40th Grand Prix victory in one of the true shockers of recent F1 history. On top of that, we review whether Mercedes got their strategy calls wrong, Kimi Raikkonen's interesting race, Toro Rosso's being the class of the midfield, McLaren, Force India playing dirty, and Manna, who actually managed to finish a Grand Prix. Hooray.
I had no idea.
You would never have known from all the press they got, you know? Like, yay, well done for finishing. Woo! Congratulations for doing exactly what you were set out to do in the first place. Like, let's give these dudes a pat on the friggin' back. Anyway, more of that later. We'll be also talking about MotoGP in Qatar this past day, and Valentino Rossi is still a riding god, essentially. 36 years young, 20th season in the motorsport category, and he's still winning races at the age of 36. May the good Lord help us all. Also, surprise performances from Ducati. Andrea Dovizioso is still a thing, and Ducati are actually really good this year. Uh-oh.
Italian bike on the podium?
What? To be fair, that wasn't that uncommon. Carl Crutchlow got on the podium last year in Aragon.
That is true.
But that was a wet podium, funnily enough. This was their first dry podium, I think, since 2010, I think it was. So something along those lines. We'll be talking about the Hondas. Marc Marquez making a bit of a dog's dinner of turn one, but still finishing in fifth because he's Marc Marquez. Danny Pedrosa finishing sixth, and why he might not be riding again for a good while yet, as well as reviews of Moto 2 and Moto 3. Look out for King, he only just finished watching the race about half an hour ago. Apparently it was quite good. Also, I've got a shocking announcement to make. I've lost my virginity. So the world of IndyCar. Yeah, I watched my very first IndyCar Grand Prix as their season kicked off in St. Petersburg this past week, and we'll be talking all about that. Juan Pablo Montoya winning, which means hooray, crack for everyone. was that a Colombian joke? I think it was. We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about how Penske pretty much curb stomped the field with the combination of Montoya and power. That's literally willpower, not power, even though both could quite frankly apply. And we'll be talking about 15,000 broken M plates that the Honda cars all suffered during the Grand Prix, and how one poor fan ended up in hospital as a result of one. You'll see what I'm talking about there. And finally, we'll be talking about Susie Wolf again. Yep, we might have to pinch the Susie Wolf report from the Finish Line podcast from our friends of the show, King and Athlete VG. And talking about the possibility of a female F1, was it just Bernie being Bernie again? Or was there something more to it? And is there consequences to that, given the state of play when it comes to women in motorsport in general? And I've invited King to have an open floor to talk about this during the podcast, no holds barred. If that isn't worth listening to, then I don't know what is. So all that and probably a 15,000 tangents on this next bumper edition of Motorsport 101. Let's talk about the Malaysian Grand Prix. My word. And, kind of emotional.
just a little bit. Just a little emotional.
Yeah, I totally didn't bore my eyes out like a child when Sebastian Vettel crossed the line to take the Malaysian Grand Prix in one of the most truly shocking wins of our time, where Merckx, I think for the first time in a good season and a chunk, were literally beaten at their own game.
Yeah, I mean, they said it themselves, they were beaten fair and square.
They said it on their Twitter page after the race. A lot of their fans, which I find hilarious, because Merckx have got more Twitter followers than any other team. And I find it amazing that the one time that Merckx didn't win, their fans are immediately throwing them under the bus. which makes me think there's still probably quite a strong, like, Seattle Seahawks level of bandwagon going on with the Mercedes fans, because they're now good. In this case, really, really good.
Yeah, but, really, really good.
Yeah, but on their Twitter account, they straight up said they beat us fair and square, and they said that even if they did run a two-stopper, that they probably weren't able to keep up with Ferrari's long-running pace. What the hell happened, King?
Well, I mean, a lot of the technically minded guys out there have been saying the Ferrari was able to match the Mercedes that day because it was designed by James Allison, and James Allison also designed the 2013 Lotus, and his cars are known for being very, very light on the tires, great on tire wear. So when it comes to really hot circuits, his cars tend to do better than what they normally do.
Well, yeah, it makes sense given that Kimi Raikkonen won the very first race of the thing. Was it the 2013 season in Australia? He won on a,
yeah.
I believe that was on a two-stopper when the rest of the field were on three-stoppers, and it's almost like a carbon copy of that, essentially, where there were faster cars in terms of raw pace, because as you saw in the second half of the Grand Prix, Hamilton was closing in on Vettel a bit, but not by anywhere near enough to make it interesting towards the end. And Hamilton genuinely disgruntled at the fact that there was seemingly nothing they could do to chase that Ferrari.
Yeah. It seems like when it's hot outside, Mercedes are going to have a real handful.
Yeah, essentially, that it's almost like the 2013 season all over again, where Merckx had the raw speed to match Red Bull and all the other teams in the field, but their tyre wear was so bad, they were almost always on an inferior strategy. Like in Spain a couple years ago, when they had to four-stop around there.
Yeah, I mean, strategy, when it comes to strategy at Mercedes, it was never necessary for them to be good at strategy. It was always, we were okay, we're an average team, and then last year we had the best car by far, so it didn't, having great strategy didn't mean anything, because we were basically gonna win anyway.
Essentially, yeah, like Merckx, last year Merckx were so good, they were beating people by 5/10, 6/10 a lap, to the point where they could run a three-stopper, or they could run a weaker strategy on paper, and it wouldn't really mean a damn thing, because they were just that good, essentially. And yeah, like, in this case, it looks like Ferrari have legitimately found something here where they can give the top teams a run for their money in hotter climates. So maybe we'll watch out for them in Spain, maybe, as well, down the road.
Yeah, I mean, there are not that many, like, Malaysia is the hottest track on the on the calendar.
Track temperature was like 60 degrees, wasn't it, during the Grand Prix? And that's ridiculous. You can boil an egg on that kind of temperature.
Yeah, and now that Bahrain is no longer a daylight race, that's off, and it's basically down to just being Spain, maybe Singapore, and those are the only extreme heat venues left.
I say we hit the ball with some global warming. We're gonna cook Monza and get Vettel a home win.
It's like maybe they could have gotten like if the Nürburgring was on the calendar this year, maybe Ferrari could have gotten them there.
Yeah, maybe it's one of those things. So is it going to be a matter of Ferrari only really being a contender when the track is really hot, or are they legitimately faster, or as fast, or getting closer? It looks like on paper they're just straight up closer, period.
Yeah, they are straight up closer. That's the only reason why running long actually worked, because they did have the pace. But it's the Mercedes is still the best car out there, without a doubt.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, people were trying to tell me that, oh, Vettel had the best car today, so therefore he won. And it's like, well, have you missed the last, like, 20 races? Like, all of a sudden, that Ferrari had the best car because it was a bit warm out there? Like, come on now. We all know that 17 times out of 20, Mercs are going to be faster still.
If there isn't a case of extreme weather, unless it's extremely hot or pouring rain, it is all down to either Vettel or Raikkonen hustling that car ahead of the Mercedes.
Yeah, and that was, without any shadow of a doubt, one of Sebastian Vettel's greatest performances in an F1 car to date. That was a truly incredible drive, and his pace was exceptional, and he could tell he extracted every inch out of that Ferrari that he could, in terms of tyre wear and in terms of raw speed. He got the balance just about spot on there, and it worked beautifully. I mean, when was the last time we saw Mercedes that thoroughly beaten on raw speed in terms of, you know, combination of raw speed, tyre strategy, and degradation? I mean, we're going back to 2013 here.
Yeah, probably like exactly this time in 2013.
Yeah, back when Merckx had severe tyre wear problems. And, you know,
before Merckx has even won a single Grand Prix after the return.
Well, you could argue, didn't Rosberg win in China in 2012?
Yeah, I know. That was 2013, wasn't it?
That was 12.
Oh, no, that was 2012. Yeah, you're right, because Schumacher was still on the team.
Yep, Schumacher was in the team. That was the race of that enormous 2-13 train that were going on, and Raikkonen was at the front until he had a puncher, and it was absolute carnage at the end of that Grand Prix. Like, the last 10 laps were ridiculous. It's the most exciting part of a Chinese Grand Prix you'll ever see, because China normally sucks. So, you know, if you're bored, find the last 10 laps of that Grand Prix. Tell them I sent you. But essentially, yeah, an incredible performance from Sebastian. And people are saying that, you know, Merckx got it wrong. There wasn't much Merckx could do, and Merckx said it themselves. Even on a two-stopper, they probably wouldn't have got it right. And, you know, Hamilton, there wasn't much he could do at the peak of his powers. Rosberg had a real bad day at the office, by the looks of it. You know, By the time he was in clear air, it was already too late. He'd lost too much ground to Hamilton to challenge, because he was put on the mediums right at the end. Didn't really have an effect there. It looks like Rosberg struggled in traffic as well, by the looks of it, King.
Yeah, it really did look like he struggled in traffic. It seemed like the only way... It seemed like most of his overtakes were just through sheer intimidation, that people just saw Silver Arrow in their mirrors and they're just tensed up.
Yeah, it's like, oh shit, there's a Merckx behind me! And then Carlos, like I saw, there was literally a moment where Carlos Sainz Jr., who was ahead of him at that point in the race, literally locked up into the final corner, allowing Rosberg the easiest pass of his career. This actually happened two or three times. I think Grosjean did it too at one point, where he locked a wheel into a corner, and then that's how Rosberg got through. And it wasn't through any fault of his own. And even, I think maybe it was a little bit of arrogance from Rosberg, in the sense of, I think maybe given the nature of last season, he thought, oh, I'm just going to straight up power past these dudes because of DRS and the fact that our Mercs power units are that good. Not yeah, anymore!
Yeah, it's like, exactly. It's more like, I'll get around him. I'll get around him and still have enough time to, you know, catch up. It's not a big deal. I'm in a Mercedes.
Not anymore, kids, because the Ferrari power unit actually has some legitimate speed in it now, by the looks of it. And it looks like Ferrari are very close in terms of speed traps and whatnot. So yeah, Rosberg just a very bad day at the office. He admitted it on his Twitter page in his video blog after the race. He looked like someone had beaten the crap out of him, first of all. Like maybe metaphorically rather than literally. I know Malaysia's a very hot day.
Yeah. And
maybe he couldn't take Eddie Jordan on the podium, I don't know. That could drive any man to ruin. But yeah, Rosberg looked like he'd been through WrestleMania, essentially. And he looked like a beaten man that day, and just felt like, you know what? Like, did you see David Coulthard's column about this, saying that he had concerns over Rosberg?
No, I read the headlines and I heard some comments about it, but I've yet to read it. And I don't know, like deep concerns. I would say it's a bit too soon. It's only the second race of the season.
Mm-hmm. It's only the second race of the season, and people forget that Hamilton got off to the better start last year, too. Like,
yeah.
The only reason Hamilton was behind was because of, obviously, the Australia retirement last year. But you got to remember, Hamilton was the better man early on last year, too. So this just shouldn't be too much of a surprise to people. It's just, I think the thing that caught Hamilton by surprise was the fact that, oh, Vettel's behind you, and he's only back by 3 points, and he looked like someone that just robbed his girlfriend again. He's like, what? He looked like he'd seen a ghost when he found out that Vettel's actually worked out. He's actually got 40 points and is only 3 behind you.
Yeah, that's what happens when you have a third place and a win. It kind of seems logical.
It's like, oh my god, math! what a surprise! I know you guys whipped Seb's arse in Australia, yeah, but it's still 15 points for third, in case you didn't realise. Also, the people was all seen Felipe Massa fourth in the championship as well. Like, oh yeah, Massa's the best of the rest. How about that? My brother behind me starts celebrating. He's a Felipe Massa fan, and he's sitting there during this podcast taping, and you know, he's giving us the Daniel Bryan yes chance because Massa's fourth in the championship. God bless him, Felipe. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that in just a second. But yeah, I mean, running down the rest of the grid, Kimi Raikkonen in fourth. Raikkonen had a very eventful Grand Prix. We all know he was starting from 11th after getting caught out in qualifying 2 the previous day. So everyone was curious to see where he would end up. And, you know, had a puncture early on. I think lap 2 he had suffered a puncture. And when Felipe Nasr stuck his nose where it was not needed or wanted and created a rear puncture on the back of Raikkonen's car, he had to limp around for the entire lap with 3 wheels on his wagon, got to the pit lane. Apparently he lost downforce, according to Allison, he lost downforce after that, but he was still able to come home in fourth place after the safety car, early on after Marcus Ericsson beached his Sauber, in the gravel at turn 1. Raikkonen clawed his way back, made off some pretty decent passes, and ended up finishing in fourth. So, when it comes to damage limitation, I think Kimi Raikkonen would gladly take that.
Yeah, fourth is better than not finishing, and compared to last race, I don't know. It seems like Kimi could have gotten third if he had a perfectly smooth Grand Prix and nothing happened. But again, that's just an if. I think we have to wait in China to see where Kimi really is.
Yeah, like Kimi Raikkonen at the moment just can't catch a break more than anything else. I mean, Australia, he was very unlucky. He was screwed by 1, traffic, 2, a bad pit stop, and 3, a horrific pit stop. That put him out of the Grand Prix, and his pace was looking good. I mean, he had half a chance of still finishing in fourth in Australia as well before the final pit stop he had to go through. So, yeah, I mean, Raikkonen's, I think, is waiting for a little bit of luck, but I think he's up there. I think Ferrari have built a package where both their drivers seem to be liking the direction the car's going in at the moment.
Yeah, as almost everyone has stated, morale is definitely high at Ferrari.
Yeah, the confidence, the morale in the camp. I mean, Ferrari lost their darn minds when Vettel crossed the line. I don't think even they expected a win in their second race on this new era. Like, the morale is high. There's Italians kissing each other in the paddock. Sebastian
Vettel.
The
swagger in their step is back.
The swagger is back. Vettel is doing the Schumacher leap on the podium. Even Raikkonen's cracking a smile in photographs. And, you know, Allison's over the moon. He couldn't believe what he'd been able to do with that car during the Grand Prix. And it looks like Ferrari are back. And that is a terrifying thought.
Yeah, I think one of the pictures that told me just everything I needed to know was a picture of after one of the McLarens retired, and it's Fernando Alonso walking back to the McLaren garage in front of the Ferrari garage. You just see crew members visibly laughing at him.
Oh, wow! Imagine that. Oh, my God. Alonso walking past the Ferrari garage and members of his old team laughing at him as he's going past. That's gonna be the ultimate burn.
That's everything I needed to know about Alonso's time at Ferrari,
yeah.
Where Ferrari is now, just everything I needed to know in one picture.
That has got to sum it all up right there. If your old team is laughing at you for your failures, they clearly didn't like you very much.
Yeah.
Like, I think that kind of goes without saying, really. But, yeah, I mean, we'll talk about the McLarens in a little bit more detail. But, yeah, I wonder how Fernando Alonso's feel. I think he's pretending... Like in Martin Brundle's column this morning, he described Alonso's pretending to be the happiest man on Earth. And I think that summed it up quite well. Because he can't be happy deep down at this. He can't. His ego's too big for that.
I mean, that's why they didn't like it at Ferrari, because his ego's that big.
His ego is outrageous. And, you know, he's outrageous. And, you know, he came out the other day and said that, you know, to beat Mercedes, you've got to do something different. And I completely agree with that. And, you know, to a degree, like, you're never going to beat the factory team when you're on the same power unit. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a theory about that coming up in a minute when we talk about Williams. But I see his logic as to why he went to McLaren Honda. But Honda are nowhere near there yet. And Ron Dennis has been very proud in bragging about the aero power of their car. My response to that is, I've not seen anything special from that McLaren car to suggest that their aero is going to be that good once they get up there. If they ever get up there.
It's... I mean, if it's the power unit, which is obviously the power unit because the power unit hasn't been able to finish a race. I mean, it finished, what? It finished one car out of four, and that's just terrible. That's just terrible. Mm. If it's the aero, like, it doesn't matter how great your aero is.
It's a power unit sport now.
Yeah, it's always been. If your engine blows up before the race is over, it doesn't matter how great your aero is.
Exactly. Not to mention, if you want to see a team with engine problems but bragging about their aero, look at friggin' Red Bull right about now. What does that tell you? I'm not sure we'll get to that in a minute, but yeah, down the road, I mean, Merckx just still seemingly got a long way to go. Not a lot of people have said to me, Dre, like, where do you think they'll end up once they get their power unit up there? Well, what is 100% for Honda at the moment? Like, we have no idea what their maximum is yet, and they're being ultra conservative to preserve their engines, even though they've made the rule where you can run 5 engines now instead of 4 for the season. But, I don't know about... I mean, the jury's still out on Honda for me, and I don't see them going anywhere fast until at least deep into the European season, more than anything else, because they got a long way to go. I mean, they looked semi-competitive during the race when they were actually running. Like, they were running with Force India, which probably makes Force India look really friggin' stupid right about now, given that's how far behind they are at the moment.
Yeah, I mean... It's anything behind the Red Bulls, you really should be considering how well your team's doing.
Exactly. And essentially, that's how far back they are. Like, Red Bull really would be the target at the moment, I would say, given they're on Renault powers and they're clearly not at their best at the moment either. But, yeah, they got a long way to go. But we talked about Ferrari. We talked about Kimi. Let's talk about Williams. And Williams... not a good day at the office for the Williams boys. I know they finished 5-6 and, you know, winners of the, what I like to call the Best of the Rest award, really, because the other two teams were far ahead. I mean, Valtteri Bottas was 70 seconds off the win. That is alarming.
Yeah, I mean, the Williams boys were there entangling with each other, and it was interesting, but they weren't really going anywhere. They were pretty much just start at the third row, finish on the third row. That was pretty much their story for the day.
Yep, they were clearly better than the Renault-powered boys, you know, behind them in terms of the grid, because obviously Bottas started from 10th, and Massa started, I think, from 8th, I think, or 7th, I think, or something like that. Third row or something like that, but yeah, like they finished 5-6, and given that they were running Ferrari quite close in Malaysia, and now all of a sudden they were literally over a minute behind the winning car, which was a Ferrari in Malaysia, Williams have got to be concerned about that.
Yeah, they're clearly missing something, and I think we touched on what that something is before, where it's like, if you want to succeed in Formula One, gotta be a factory team.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that this is the theory I'm coming out with now, that basically, I think Brundle came out with this as well the day after I thought this up, but don't you think that now Mercedes might give Williams a bit more support in an attempt to try and upset the Ferrari apple cart, now that they are probably going to be their biggest rivals this year?
Yeah, the quote-unquote rear gunners theory.
Yeah, the rear gunners theory. If you can help Williams out, it's one of those you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours situations, basically. Where if they can make Williams slightly better in terms of a car and can maybe beat Ferrari on the off occasion, it'll probably help both of them in the long run. Is that crazy to suggest?
Yeah, I mean, but then you're also... It could be a Pandora's box. It could be like... Yes, you do get Ferrari off your back, but now you have, you know, Williams on your back instead.
Because Williams went a million miles away at the end of last season. Felipe Massa was very close in Abu Dhabi. I don't know how much of that was down to Hamilton playing ultra-conservative with his car on the last stint of that Grand Prix, but Williams were definitely stronger than Red Bull were in the second half of last season. On the whole, I think what cost Williams more was their bad strategizing and often faulty pit stops, which I think hurt them big on occasion. But luckily, there was nobody else around them in that same 4 or 5 ballpark. When it came to the constructors, so Williams were kind of in no man's land where that was concerned, and it looks like they're kind of in no man's land again this season if Ferrari really are that far ahead. But they are obviously miles better than Red Bull.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Williams have definitely, like, improved compared to last year.
Oh, yeah, because they've got a win to play with, you know.
Yeah, but Mercedes and Ferrari have improved exponentially. That's the thing about being a factory team compared to being, you know, a privateer. You have more room to work with because you have complete and total design control over every component on your car, while Williams, yes, you can build a great chassis, but you do have to design it around an engine, which you have no control over.
Indeed, and therein lies the problem. You've really got to be a factory team these days. But let's see if that was a one-off and see if Williams can close back in a little bit around China next weekend. Moving on, we have another history-making moment as young Max Verstappen, at the age of 17, became Formula One's all-time youngest scorer, after finishing in impressive 7th place there, ahead of his teammate Carlos Sainz, and the sister team beating the factory boys. How very 2008.
It's like 2008? Well, hopefully we're not 2000 and late.
Yeah, like who knows, but gotta say, what happened to the Red Bull boys finishing 9 and 10 and getting beaten by the sister team? Was Franz Tost onto something when he said, you know, 5th was a possibility in the constructors this year?
I don't know. It seems like, I know Cyril Abitbol, the director at Renault, earlier in the week, he got a lot of flack for straight up saying that Adrian Newey was a bit of a liar for blaming all of Red Bull's problems on Renault.
What did you make of that, for what it's worth?
I mean, yes, Renault's power unit's definitely behind, but this race clearly proved that maybe Adrian Newey got it a bit wrong this year.
It's, I mean, the sister team should not be beating you, period. Like, like that is written in red at the bottom of the contract, in bold and underlined, like I said, colored red for extra emphasis. Do not have Toro Rosso beat you. And now Toro Rosso are ahead of them in the Constructors. They have 1 point more than Red Bull's 11 after two rounds. And if you're Christian Horner, boy, like that man is turning a different shade of purple by the looks of it, given that Red Bull are a mile off where they need to be at the moment.
But admittedly, both the new boys at Toro Rosso outclassed Kvyat and Ricciardo out there on track during race day. Like Verstappen did a Ricciardo on Ricciardo.
Yeah,
he faked to the right and dove inside.
I was astonished by that. Like, I was like, this kid is 17 and he's in his second ever race, and he's smacking Daniel Ricciardo around, the People's Champion of 2014. Like, wait a minute. Like, have we overrated Ricciardo all this time if Max Verstappen can smack him around like that?
Or maybe Verstappen's that good. Verstappen's that good.
Or maybe Max really is that good, because, boy, if he can pull that off in his second Grand Prix, just wait until he grows a set and learns how to actually race.
Oh, dear.
It's like the Blake Griffin argument. He's such an athletic freak, he was able to get away with having a lack of skill kind of power forward. As Charles Barkley said, just wait till he learns how to play basketball. it's that kind of theory again. But, you know, great performance from Max Verstappen. Very impressed with what he was able to do. The kid's clearly got some talent. Maybe Red Bull knew better than we thought about it when it came to VMAX. And Carlos Sainz, again, another very solid performance in 8th place. There we go. Made the two-stopper work for him quite nicely. And remember, he started from 15th on the grid. So if anybody had an Andy GP predictor, your quid's in, because he had the joint most number of positions gained alongside Kimi Raikkonen, who went from 11th to 4th, both up 7 from their original starting spot. So well done, Carlos Sainz, as well.
And another week, I pick wrong, and I didn't pick him. I picked Ricciardo.
King, this is why you should leave the predicting to the big boys.
Exactly.
You are talking to the man who is currently third in the Dre TV GP Predictor League. I'll post the link up after I take this show. If you want to join the GP Predictor League that I'm in for Dre TV, you can join. Winning guy will get a free Harrison 101 t-shirt. So, you know, there's all the incentive to either join. It's harmless, it's free, and you can mock me if you beat me in a week, which probably won't happen because I was the 8th high scorer this week. And I'm currently 3rd overall. Only because some crazy guy called Jay, like, I think it was chatting to a guy called Jay in the league who I know follows me on Twitter, and he actually got 6 correct runners this week. So he got the 60-point bonus where that's concerned. Like,
I mean, logically, you could do that if for some reason you decided to pick up both Mercedes and, like...
Yeah, like, I looked at mine, like, I got the podium all, like, one out, so I got 5 for each of those, because who would have been stupid enough to predict Vettel winning? Essentially, like, I think Vettel was still the only guy on Earth who actually believed he could win that race. But, essentially, yeah, that was a thing. And then I had the Williams spawn in 5 and 6, which I was quite happy about that at least. And I think I got Daniel Kvyat in 9th spot on as well. But yeah, imagine that as well, like Ricciardo being given team orders to let Kvyat through.
Just to say one thing, at least I got the full 10 for having Hamilton second, but I didn't have Vettel for the win.
Of course, you went with Blondie. Well done, King. Well done. Yeah, I had Hamilton for the win. And I had Hamilton for the win, Rosberg second, Vettel third. And, yeah, that didn't go well. Well, it went okay. I got 5 for each. I guess that's not the end of the world, I suppose. could have been worse. But, yeah, 58 points this week. I think I'll gladly take that. In the grand scheme of things, like I said, there was the 8th highest score in my league this week, so that's not too bad, really. Shout out to my boy CalHD1 as well, because he's one spot ahead of me. He's a point ahead of me. So take that, Cal.
Yeah, I just looked it up. I'm 52nd. I'm 52nd out of 56, fighting to avoid relegation.
Oh, Lord. He's in the relegation scrap with Manor, McLaren, and Hull City. so yeah, that's a thing. Speaking of which, Manor! They finished!
Yay!
Yay! Yeah, congratulations, I guess, to the Manor team, because you know what F1's like on the internet. We're all gonna, you know, sarcastically, you know, condescendingly say, well done, Manor, well done for finishing. You know, and it's like, God. Like, the inner cynic in me is just like, well, fuck this. Like, seriously.
Anyone who says anything in disrespect to Manor will get killed on Twitter.
Like I did. I've had that happen to me at least, like, on my Facebook page. It happened on my Twitter. It happened on my Ask FM. It's like, Dre, why are you hating on Manor? And it's like, we want more cars on the grid. And I'm like, really? This is what you wanted? A car that doesn't get any time on the hard camera and is lapped 3 times. And I'm honestly stunned it was only 3.
Like, to be honest, like, anytime they were even being lapped, they weren't even on the hard camera. They were showing a battle elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's like me and Ryan joked, was like, oh, look, a Manor sighting. And it was like, we saw him like maybe twice the whole Grand Prix. And one of the times was when Mehi, who was driving the one working Manor, that passed Raikkonen, who had the puncher. It's like, oh, so that's that Manor, it's still alive. So that was a thing. They were lucky to even be able to race, given they did not qualify under the 107% provision. But the stewards gave them a pass and let them compete anyway, mainly because their free practice 2 time was actually representative. So, yay, I suppose. Yeah. Only running the one car is not a good look either, but to be honest, chaps. But, you know, the fans will support them, you know, because, you know, unfortunately, the Manor's engine isn't powered by said fans, otherwise they'd be winning the championship right about now. But, you know, I've spoken about Manor enough on this podcast, and anyone who's a regular listener will know exactly how I feel about them being in Formula One. And let's just say I actually kind of am buddies with Bernie Eccleston on this one for the most part. It's just the whole emphasis of why are you here, basically.
I feel the same way, but I mean, there's still one big question that needs to be answered if Manor's going to stay in the sport for at least this season. Bahrain's coming up, and that's, I mean, is it Bahrain or Spain? But the start of the GP2 season is coming up, and Roberto Meri is going to just leave. Because number one, he has a super license. That's going to be he's going to have a super license for the next 3 years, and he's just going to leave and go back to GP2, because there's no reason for him to stay there.
Yeah, isn't he in Formula Renault 3.5, Meri? This season.
Oh, is it 3.5?
I'm pretty sure it's 3.5, you know.
It's like, yeah, but he's going to leave. Who's going to replace him?
Let's go Jordan King.
Let's go Jordan King.
You can back your fellow King. Insert joke.
It's
here.
Like, I mean, Jordan King already said he's not racing this year, so
yeah,
it looks highly unlikely.
Yeah, essentially, for all intents and purposes, while I look at my Oscar inbox, somebody's telling me, ha ha, Jorge Lorenzo will win the championship. live hate mail on air, everybody. But essentially, yeah, I mean, Jordan King's, I mean, I think that was on Downforce Debrief, friend of the show, Lester Forbes, his show, don't listen to him. This is a competition. But I think he said he wasn't racing on that show, so fair enough. I think they played his interview again on, you know, and whatnot. So, hey, that's a thing. So if not, who are they going to call besides Ghostbusters, obviously?
I don't know. I mean, there are a couple of people hanging around the Formula One paddock with super licenses, but I highly doubt they want to drive for Banner.
Should I give you the Jake Sanson answer? Susie Wolf, get her in the car.
It's like, at this moment, it's like Susie Wolf, but I mean, the FIA doesn't release a list of who has a super license or not, and you do need a super license to race during, like, to drive a car during a Grand Prix weekend, which Susie Wolf has done. But apparently, I did not know this until recently, but there's a practice-only version of the super license with almost the same requirements.
Huh. Now, that is interesting.
So right now, the only person with the super license at the moment who I know is in the paddock and is not signed with any team right now is Guido Vandergaard, but I know he doesn't want to drive for them.
Oh, God. Not that old chestnut again. Let's leave the Guido Vandergaard one exactly where it is, like as far away from an F1 car as possible, before we end up being in a courtroom somewhere in Bahrain.
Which Bahrain has courtrooms?
It's like, which I, no. A courtroom is probably the wall next to where the firing squad's at. Hooray for that being a thing. So, enough about Formula 1 for now. We'll come back to that in a bit. MotoGP, everybody. And, we had the season opener, ironically enough, in Qatar. Season opener. And, a shocking race, but not for the reasons you might expect. Rule number one, never doubt Valentino Rossi. Rule number two, repeat step one. And obviously the other notes, holy crap, Ducati are competitive. When did this become a thing?
Oh, it's like, maybe the winglets work. Maybe the winglets work.
Oh my god, the winglets work. This is actually a thing. But, Ducati, second and third in that Grand Prix behind the winner, Valentino Rossi, who won... You know, who won an incredible win for Valentino Rossi. It was the two Yamahas and the two Ducatis in their own dogfight, pretty much from start to finish. They're in a class of their own, though, that front four, while the Hondas had a terrible start. Marquez got beached on the first corner by Lorenzo, sticking his back wheel out, basically, round turn one, and Marquez having to take evasive action. But he clawed his way through to finish in fifth. While the Pedrosa struggled along in sixth. We had Yoni Hernandez up there for a little while as well, but he slipped back towards the end, unfortunately. But, it was the two Yamahas of Lorenzo and Rossi and the two Ducatis, the factory Ducatis of Andrea Dovizioso and Andrea Iannone, with Lorenzo falling back towards the end because, and get this, the inside of his helmet collapsed, and he lost half of his vision in the process. Imagine doing that at 215 miles an hour down Qatar's home straight.
On a motorcycle
with three other dudes within the same stretch of 50 meters of tarmac as you.
It's like, oh, I need to clean out my racing leathers after that.
Yeah, like his leathers went from blue and white to a nice bright shade of brown.
Oh, God.
But, in the process, we also had, like I said, we had both Ducatis on the podium. Dovi in second, his best race result since Assen last year, where that was affected by rain as well. I think it was Ducati's first dry podium since 2010. And Andrea Iannone getting his first Grand Prix podium after his career-high best of finish of fifth. I think he did it three times last year for the Pramac Ducati team. So Iannone's first Grand Prix podium as well, and I'm sure he'll be one to watch for race wins down the road if Ducati are competitive. But the thing is now is that, on top of that, they're going to start giving up some of their concessions because as this was Ducati's third dry podium since the start of the 2014 season, they now have to reduce their fuel load from 24 to 22 litres. So they have less fuel to run in races now from here on in, so they can't burn fuel as high a rate as they used to, which might affect some of that ridiculous straight-line speed they had during the Grand Prix in Qatar, where they were passing dudes for fun on that home straight, like Casey Stoner was back on with the team.
Yeah. Like, at first, I was surprised, because I don't follow MotoGP that closely, so I didn't know they had equalization, like, rules like that to hamper teams that are that far ahead.
Exactly. Basically, Ducati ran as a Factory 2 team, which meant they got concessions. So, you know, that, when Ducati announced they were being effectively an open-class runner for 2014, that pissed everybody off. Especially Honda. Honda were livid about this. And, you know, they're like, this is completely unfair and whatnot. And now people are actually starting to moan more about Ducati now they're actually gotten good. Hervé Poncherolle, the team principal of the Tech 3 team, essentially said he thought it was completely unfair that Ducati are running softer rubber than everybody else. Obviously, they're going to be faster in qualifying and whatnot because they're on softer rubber due to the concessions. My response to that is, well, if they're good, they're going to give it up anyway. So don't worry too much. If they are that good, it won't be for very long, essentially, because three dry wins and they give up their tyres. So they would not be able to run the softer compound tyre in qualifying and in races. Because as you, I don't know if you know this, King, but if you're an open class runner, you can run the two softer compounds in a Grand Prix weekend, whereas if you're a factory runner, you have to run the two harder compound tyres instead. So, for example, in Qatar, if you're a factory runner like Marquez, you could only run the hard or the medium. If you're Ducati, you could run the medium or the soft. Get it?
Yeah, I understood the open class rules.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. I don't have to explain that to everybody else who hasn't. We haven't talked a lot about MotoGP on this podcast so far, to be fair, so a lot of people might not know that. Running down the rest of the field real quick, Cal Crutchlow in 7th, not a decent recovery from his 12th place start after his qualifying crash as well. Not such a good day for Scott Redding on his big satellite bike debut. Ha ha, Rebecca. sorry, I had to say that. It was, you know, she's that adamant that she thinks Redding's going to be on the podium this year, which I think is just hilarious. Given that Redding finished in 13th, more than anything else. Bradley Smith beating his teammate. Bradley Smith beating Pola Spargaro for 8th and 9th. And nice to see Alicia Spargaro in 11th place as well for the new Suzuki team in their first Grand Prix. Both Suzuki's getting in the points. So well done to Suzuki for a decent first Grand Prix, especially given they are 10 mile an hour slower than the rest of the field at the moment, given their bike is down on power. So well done, Alicia, and well done teammate Maverick Vinales for getting in the points in 14th as well. And Hector Barbera being the top open class runner in 15th place, getting the points. But the big shocking news after the Grand Prix came out was Danny Pedrosa. And he revealed that he has an arm pump problem that just refuses to go away. Apparently the story goes he was riding the entire 2014 season with severe arm pump issues, basically, and he was hoping the off-season and alternative medicine, basically, thinking he's Steve Jobs, essentially, alternative medicine was, you know, thinking that that might solve the problem. Turns out it didn't, really, and it's come back again in Qatar this round, and it didn't really help, and Pedrosa says he's essentially stepping down indefinitely until he can find another way around this problem, mainly because it's inoperable for the most part. The doctors recommended not to operate on it because they tried it before and it didn't solve the problem, so there's no real point in going back in there again, basically. So, a hammer blow for the Repsol Honda team, King.
Yeah, I mean, I'm used to arm pump situations like in motocross, and for those who don't know, arm pump is a colloquial term for chronic exertional compartment syndrome.
In your
arm, it's basically so it's basically the muscles in your forearms.
Mm.
To a degree, all your muscles are elastic, but there's a casing around your muscles, which isn't. It's like, think of it like a sausage.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, I suppose. God. So, real mature on this show.
So the arm pump becomes a problem because blood rushes into your arm anytime you, use them.
Mm.
But the thing is, old blood can only leave your arm at a certain rate. So the more force you exert through your arms, the more blood forces its way in, but the old blood can only leave at one set rate.
Wow.
So basically your muscle starts expanding against the sides of the casing to the point where it starts to hurt. And that's usually the first symptom of arm pump, pain.
Yeah, which I'm guessing Pedrosa had a lot of last season, given he's been doing that nonstop for, 8 months is a MotoGP season, and that's brutal in its own right. And Pedrosa stepping down in the short term, which of course got everybody talking. Let's bro Casey Stoner. let's bring back Casey in that sense, which I thought was just hilarious in its own right. Every time there's a possibility that a Honda rider's contract runs out or something happens to Pedrosa, all the whispers about Casey Stoner start up again, who is coming back to motorcycling, but he's riding the 8 hours of endurance race for Suzuka. For Suzuki, I should say, as well. He's riding the 8 hour there for them. So I don't see him riding for Honda in the near future. I mean, everyone's throwing Kyle Crutchlow's name into the hat as well, obviously given he's the top satellite rider for Honda at the moment with the LCR team. So they might bring up a privateer like Crutchlow. I think the safer bet is you use your test rider, which is Hiroshi Ayama, who you might remember last year from the Aspar team, who was on the production Honda last year. So I think Ayama is the best bit where that's concerned. But Livio Super was very confident in proclaiming that he reckons Pedrosa will be good to go for America still.
Seeing the way MotoGP is now, Danny Pedrosa can't come back. Because the most prominent riding style is an off-body riding style where you use
body out
a lot of your forearms. Because most doctors recommend to basically prevent arm pump, because that's the best way it's better to just use preventative methods than to have surgery to relieve it, because it will just come back quicker.
Yikes. Which is why I'm guessing the doctors told him not to do it again, basically, not to have another surgery on it, because like, what's the point, really? It seems like it's the nature of the job, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because the best way to prevent arm pump is using your legs to lean the bike in, which you can't do with using an off-body riding style.
Yeah, like, this isn't the days of Alex Crivier and, you know, guys like Mick Doohan, who had that big, old-school, classic, like, upright style, like, shoulders level, you know, not like... It's not like Marc Marquez today, who's able to get 63-degree lean angles on his bikes and having... It's the same style that Scott Redding holds as well, where it's a very body-out kind of style, using all of your body to try and lean the bike in as hard as you possibly can, and that's part of the reason why Marquez has been so good, and also part of the reason why Rossi's been so good, because Rossi has adapted his riding style, learning from dudes like Marquez. So, it's the nature of the beast now. Like, that seems to be the fastest way to ride a motorcycle these days. Pedrosa's in some trouble, and I think Livio was playing the PR card on that one. I don't see him riding in America next weekend. I really don't. I think Hiroshi Ayama will be coming in for the weekend. Just to stay the ship, see if they can get in a full privateer replacement. Maybe they'll give Crutchlow a call and say, hey, fancy a ride with the big boys for a bit? Because he was good when he was given a proper factory bike like with Yamaha a couple of years ago. So that's a possibility where that's concerned. And also, I've heard a couple of people mention Jonathan Rea as well from World Superbikes, given how he's been a loyal guy to the Honda brand for a long time in World Superbikes and only just recently jumped to Kawasaki this year and is now leading and, dominating the World Superbike Championship in the early going. And remember, the World Superbike calendar does not clash with MotoGP, so in theory, Jonathan could do it. So, there's a lot of possibilities where that's concerned. Maybe even Sylvain Guintoli as well, who's riding for the Superbike Honda team at the moment. So, who knows what's going on there, and obviously more news as we get it on that one. And obviously, wishing Danny the best, because Pedrosa is like the ultimate MotoGP bridesmaid more than anything else. A victim of his era, and a victim of getting banged up a lot, basically. He's had a lot of injuries in his career, and I know he's 29 now, and this is his 10th year in the top class, and his 10th year of Repsol Honda. It's amazing he hasn't had a world championship yet, more than anything else, or a lot of world championship in the top class anyway. Just a shocker, more than anything else, and again, wishing Danny the best, and hoping for a speedy recovery, whatever it is, and hope to see him back on the bike soon, because I like Danny. He's a very nice dude. He's a very nice dude. You know, he's like a part of the furniture now, and he's been around for 10 years, and I've been watching him ride for 12. Little Dre was a big fan of his when he was back when he had a 250 class. It seems like a long time ago now since we had a 250cc bike class in the midfield as opposed to Moto 2. Speaking of which, by the way, this is spoilers for Old King, unfortunately, because he hasn't seen Moto 2 and 3 yet, because he ran out of time before this taping. Well done, King.
I tried.
Yeah, well done, mate. But, to fill in on what happened in Moto 2 and 3, Moto 2, we had a rookie winner. We had the first time ever we've had a new debutant winner in Moto 2, and that was Jonas Volger for the AGR team, of all people, representing Team Germany and the Bavarian flags flying around Cat off. So, yeah, Jonas Volga, who you may remember from the Moto3 Championship a couple of years ago that finished in fourth behind the big Spanish trio. Jonas Volga getting his first Moto2 win. I know what you're thinking. How the hell did Jonas Volga win this race? Because the big story over the weekend was the battle between Sam Lowes and Johan Zarco. And Lowes smashed the lap record in qualifying, was insanely fast, as was Johan Zarco, clearly the best of the Kalexes. But unfortunately, Sam Lowes binned it on lap 3 during the race trying to chase Zarco down. Yeah, Sam Lowes crashed again. Stop me where you've heard that one before.
It's like, my first reaction, Bex is not going to be happy about this.
Oh, she was crying and asking for internet cuddles. She was not happy. Poor girl was in shell shock. I think we got to treat her for PTSD on the next episode of Bike Live. Poor woman. But yeah, Sam Lowes once again hitting the deck in a really good position in a Grand Prix. Stop me if you've heard that one before. So Sam Lowes hit the deck. Johan Zarco had about a 5-second lead during the race. He looked like he was going to absolutely cakewalk it because there was no competition. Mostly because Tito Rabat, one, had a terrible start, and then two, got taken out by Simone Corsi into turn one. Basically, Corsi went on around the outside of him through turn one. There was always a gap that was ever decreasing, and Corsi stuck his rear wheel out, caught the front wheel of Tito Rabat, and as Keith Heughan always says on commentary, in a battle of back wheel versus front wheel, the front wheel loses every time. And next thing you know, down goes Rabat, and the reigning champion has a donut to his name for the weekend. So the biggest two threats to Zarco was out by the end of lap 4. So you're thinking, Zarco's going to cakewalk it. But no, he had a gearbox problem. Apparently he was stuck in fifth gear with about 4 laps to go. So Zarco, from a dominant position, had a mechanical problem, and that cost him the Grand Prix. And yeah, there was a when you watch Moto 2, when you get a chance, King, look out for the onboard shot of when Zarco realizes he's got a gearbox problem, because you know the front straight in Qatar, right?
Yep.
You know how there's a warning track on the grass next to the pit wall?
Yeah.
Zarco was looking over to the left-hand side of his gearbox fairing to see if there was a problem with it, and his bike leans to the right-hand side of the track, onto the grass, and he nearly hits the wall at 130 miles an hour.
Oh, that would have been close to a season ender if he went down there.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. That would have been a disastrous crash if Zarco hit the wall there. Like, jeez, I don't know what the man was thinking. They'll show the onboard during the race. It is terrifying, quite frankly, seeing it from onboard. It's like, he's going at a good 120, 130 miles an hour, and he nearly bounces off the inside pit wall. Terrifying idea, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, terrifying, because I'm afraid to even fall off my bicycle.
Let alone a bike. You're halfway hanging off of an 130 with a concrete wall to your right. Not a good idea. So yeah, Johan Zarco ended up in 8th after that gearbox issue in the end, as Jonas Volga got the win. Xavier Simeon in 2nd, representing Belgium, matching his best Moto2 finish. And in 3rd was Thomas Luthi, his first race on the Kalex chassis. I think he'll gladly take that. Just ahead of rookie Alex Rins in his very first race. You might remember him from Moto3 last year, who was just a bike length shy of a rookie podium performance in his first race. Yeah, Alex Rins is going to be one to watch this year. He might be the next Maverick Vinales in terms of being the surprising dude on the Pons bike. Yeah, other guys you might want to keep attention to. Alex Marquez was 11th, the reigning Moto3 champion. Not the best day out in the office. As was Dominique Agata, who many thought was going to be a top contender, who was in 15th place as well, where that's concerned. Moving on to Moto3, and this was another ridiculous cluster of a race. Like, did you ever see Bruno last year, King, for Moto3?
Yes, I'm Bruno.
It was just like that, pretty much. It was a leading pack of about 10 dudes in there. But to everybody's surprise, it was the pole sitter, Alexis Masbou, who got the win in the end. The 27-year-old Frenchman who won his very first Grand Prix last season, ironically at that same Bruno race, where he knocked Miller off to one side to take the win where that was concerned. Luckily, there was no Alex Rins in the background pretending he'd won again. Essentially, he got the win. It was a fantastic race. I highly recommend you go out of your way to see it. It was overtakes almost every corner. Elbow rubbing, barging, you name it. It was fantastic. Like, Moto3 always provides brilliant entertainment, and you should watch every single Moto3 race. It's as good as motorsport can get, quite frankly, without it being legal. Miguel Oliveira, who was the fastest man of the weekend, got bumped out of turn one and had to claw his way back up to 16th in the end, where he finished up. But yeah, it was Masbou who got the win. He started the last lap in 7th place and came through to win, beating Enna Bastianini in a drag race to the finish over the line. And Bastianini started from 21st on the grid. So you could argue that was arguably the ride of the weekend from Enna Bastianini there in 2nd. And Danny Kent represented the new Leopard Racing team. My new favourite liveries in the sport, by the way. That turquoise and the black is nice. Me gusta. Well done, Leopard Racing. Danny Kent in 3rd ahead of his teammate Efren Vasquez, the oldest man in the class, in 4th. For those guys looking at the rookies, keep an eye on Fabio Quartararo. He was in 7th place. A very solid ride from the 15-year-old rookie on his debut. Watch out. That kid is a special talent. So, moving on from MotoGP, Moto2, and Moto3, we'll move on to me losing my virginity. It's a very important story. We must discuss this. I know I'm an old man at 22 by the grand scheme of things, but I've got to talk about it now. I've got to talk about IndyCar. Is this something I know of what I'd end up getting into, but I promised a good few people on my channel and the friends of the show, like Elusive Kev, you may know on YouTube, I promised I'd watch IndyCar this season, and the opening round was at the GP of St. Petersburg, and I learned quite quickly that basically Penske are the devil.
Yeah.
Is that about right? Is that the long and the short of it here?
Basically, it's like Penske has been on numerous occasions called the evil empire.
So is Willpower basically the emperor at this point? like with the cape, and basically Simon Pagenaud is Darth Vader?
I mean, I would say Willpower is just as decisive as Sebastian Vettel, except without the inherent likability.
Oh, ain't that wonderful? Willpower's just going to go around calling everybody wankers all day, basically, and give people the finger and shit. So, you know, that's got to be a thing. But, I watched my very first IndyCar race, and one, it didn't help that pretty much the entire first half of the race was under caution. There was a lot of end plates coming off the cars, King.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, specifically the Honda cars for some reason, where, I don't know if it was just the nature of the car, the drivers themselves, or whether it was just sheer coincidence, that Honda, I think, by the time we got to lap 30 out of 110, I think there was about 7 broken Honda end plates during the course of the Grand Prix, to the point where ESPN featured it as a graphic. Dude was like, here's the broken wing count, everybody, brought to you by insert sponsor here. So it's like, Chevrolet had like 7, like Honda had like 7 broken end plates on their cars, while I think Honda had just the 1. And there was end plates everywhere. And here, King, tell us a story real quick about how a guy actually got hurt by one of these things.
Yeah, apparently there was an end plate that got knocked off. It was lying in the middle of the road, and then a car came by, ran it over, launched it through the air, over the catch fence, over a grandstand, and then hit a guy in the head.
What's the odds of that?
I have no idea what's the odds.
Like, whoever that guy is, tell him to buy a lottery ticket this week. It's just like, I mean, Jesus, what are the odds that someone drives over that middle of the road end plate, it flies literally maybe 100 or 200 feet out of the track limits, past the grandstands, and hits a random dude in the head that had to be hospitalized for a head injury? Jesus.
No one foresaw this being a problem, that there would just be aero parts scattered everywhere.
Yeah, and there was a lot of incidences like that. We had our beloved Motorsport Bay and friend of the show, Simone Di Silvestro, literally take a dude out of the race.
There's like, no doubt that it's like, oh, when the stewards came across, like, Simone has been given a penalty for avoidable contact. I would say, yeah, that was completely avoidable.
Yeah, exactly. Essentially, she basically gave. I'm not. Who was the guy that she hit?
Oh God, I don't even remember who was taken out.
It was a guy in a silver car, if I remember correctly, but I can't remember what his name was.
Yeah, but I'll look it up. But it's like Sabota was trying to take this person out, even though we know for the most part it was probably a racing incident. There's no, she didn't purposely take this person out, but it looked like that. It looked like it. It looked a whole lot like it.
Because basically, Simona basically French kissed this dude off the road, man. And I'm like, oh, Simona.
He went off into the grass, and then she just took the corner like any other corner.
Yeah, we had that. We had Hinchcliffe get into a nasty one as well in that same final corner. We had Ray Hall, I think, take a dude out who activated a smoke machine, basically. I don't know who it was who had the smoke machine joke I made on the Skype when we watched this race, but Ray Hall took him out and put him in the wall, basically. He was like, no smoke machine for you.
It was Charlie Kimball got taken out.
Yeah, Kimball got taken out and plowed into the wall by Graham Ray Hall, basically, which was hilarious in its own right. It was like watching an episode of Racky Races, basically, from back in my childhood days. But in the second half of the race, we seemed to settle down a fair bit more, and despite the 15,000 commercial breaks, it was eventually Juan Pablo Montoya that would take the win over Will Power after Will made a bit of a dog's dinner of his final pit stop, basically, and after that, and after Power had one attempted pass which didn't go right and lost a part of his end plate, surprise, surprise, I think Penske basically pretty much told the order, settle down, boys, basically, and eventually it was Montoya from Power, and Tony Kanaan breaking the Penske stranglehold on the podium in third. So, yay for Tony Kanaan, still kicking ass at the age of 57.
Yeah. But, I mean, a Penske 1-2-4-5 is kind of still a curb stomp, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, jeez. When you have four of the top five locked out, I mean, that's pretty darn good, no matter which way you look at it. I mean, Simon Pagenaud and Helio Castroneves also right up there in the top five as well. So, it's a curb stomping. Full Seth Rollins style, everybody. just don't get hit by an RKO at the end. But yeah, essentially, Penske with a curb stomp. I didn't enjoy it that much, to be honest. I had more fun talking to you two about it, most more than anything else, and just cracking jokes about the whole thing, because that was... That made it pretty enjoyable. But,
yeah, the first part of the race is slow. I mean, this tends to be the usual St. Petersburg race, except with, you know, shrapnel everywhere.
Shrapnel everywhere and half a dozen cautions. And, like, I mean, they put up a stat saying that six of the last 11 St. Petersburg races have had a yellow flag caution on the opening lap. So King was even banking on a guaranteed turn one crash, and not even that happened.
the caution was called out later that lap, so...
Yeah, all we got was Ryan Hunter-Reay running a little bit wide, the Indy 500 winner from last year. wonderful. My lesson of the day is IndyCar can be a bit painful, and it was a 2.5 hour race. It was like almost exactly 2.5 hours to the minute, funnily enough, mostly because of the length of the caution flags, unfortunately, because that's just the nature of racing, really. And IndyCar races, in generally speaking, are longer because it was a 110 lap race of a 62-63 second lap. So it's basically like if you had Austria, but maybe half, like maybe 1.5 times the distance in a Formula One calendar, so it'll probably be like a 2 hour race if it was in Formula One context. But, I'm sure it will get better down the road. I think we're going to Louisiana in a couple of weeks' time, King?
Yeah, in a couple of weeks, heading for the inaugural Grand Prix of Louisiana at the newly, well, it's not newly opened, it'll be the first major race at the NOLA Motorsports Park.
Right, so yeah, the NOLA Motorsports Park for round two. It's going to be another doubleheader because it's going to be Formula One in China. We're going to have MotoGP at the Circuit of the Americas in Texas. And we're going to have the Grand Prix of Louisiana in IndyCar. So guess what, guys? Another triple header in 2 weeks' time. Hooray! So, you know, prepare for lengthy amounts of tweets and me having a concussion by the end of the night.
Hey, at least hopefully next time Simona doesn't take out James Jakes.
Ugh. Oh, there you go, James Jakes. That was what we were looking for. It was on the tip of my tongue. Oh, Simona. but essentially, that's going to be a thing. But yeah, let's talk about the last big meetup. This came out after the Grand Prix in Malaysia. The day afterwards, Bernie was quoted. Again, stop me if you've heard that one before as well. But Susie Wolf and the possibility of an all-female racing series, essentially, a women-only racing series, and the possibility of a Formula One series for women. But I'm going to take us through that a little bit more, King, before I give you your open floor.
Basically, this weekend, during an interview with the British media, because we all know how not sensationalist the British media are.
Never.
Bernie was throwing out some ideas to, you know, improve Formula One as a whole, and he threw out the idea of bringing back double points, and, you know, and his original intention of making the last two races double points. Okay. He also brought up the idea of randomizing the grid for the top 12 qualifiers, and probably the bombshell, in all-female Formula One series. This series would be, he said, we could run it on Saturdays, as, you know, Saturdays, so it won't be in the shadow of the Sunday Grand Prix. It'll be its own thing on Saturday, and they don't have to run Formula One cars, they could run GP2 cars, and maybe the teams would be interested in doing it if it was affordable.
Interesting. So, you know, it was an interesting idea, and of course, this being the internet, and of course, this being Bernie Eccleston, everybody jumped on his comments. I'm almost 99% sure that if it was anyone else, like Christian Horner coming out saying something like this, or Stefano Domenicali, or any other big name in Formula One who's a manager, or a team principal, or someone higher up, I think there would be an air of mature thought about this.
Yes.
But because it's Bernie Eccleston, and because it's Bernie being Bernie, it's like, boo this man!
Yeah, I definitely quoted you on that one.
Thanks, man. Like, I got that from Sidney Rice's Twitter page when I think it was when he was talking about Roger Goodell and Ray Rice and their new domestic violence policy. I was about to call it their new domestic violence sham, basically. And that's where I got the line from. So basically, boo this man! It was my way of describing it. And that's probably how most F1 fans react to Bernie Eccleston these days, because people are so... Because, like, you know what it is? It's like Bernie is like that soap opera character of the guy that everybody thinks is the villain.
Yeah.
But actually, it's somebody else. But because Bernie's always on TV, because Bernie's always interviewed, because Bernie is a personality when it comes to the sport, and that, you know, Bernie is that guy that's, you know, not afraid to speak his mind, and, you know, has all these ideas, and people keep asking him stuff. It's that, you know, as a result, he's going to be labeled as the victim, basically. Or he's going to be victimized for whatever he comes out with, and how it's always going to be a terrible idea. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. It's like, no matter what Bernie says, no matter, like, if it's a logical thing, it's always going to be, but Bernie said it, so boo this man!
If Bernie said it, boo this man. Bernie, it's time to go. You're too old. You're out of touch. And yada, yada, yada. And the same people that bitched about the WWE's booking for WrestleMania. Now Vince McMahon's out of touch, but then pulls off a brilliant Mania. Same logic.
same logic. And like, obviously you have moments where Bernie just says things to be Bernie. But if you do go read the quote, it seemed like he deeply cared about this.
Yeah, it's like... I can tell when Bernie's being genuine. I've met the man, and I could tell that Bernie seemed to genuinely care about this as an idea, and I'm sure Bernie would take something like this completely seriously if he was going to come out on the record and say something like it, and he did seem very sincere about the whole thing. And originally I thought, this can't be right, this is a terrible idea, and I'm thinking, you know, why would you have an all-female series? And then the more I thought about it, the more I realised there is a modicum of sense about this, but it's not going to work, but not for the reason of the concept. It's not going to work for other reasons, which I'll get to in a minute. But there's a lot of problems with the idea of doing an F1, an all-female series, or even a GP2-style all-women series. And one influence of this was Susie Wolf. And the interesting comment was, you know, a lot of people shut up about it when Susie Wolf chipped in and basically said that, you know, it was an admirable idea, but she didn't feel it was the best way forward. Or I think was what she was quoted as saying.
I'm looking at it right now. I had it just in case.
I think something along those lines, King, right?
Yeah. Wolf says, first of all, I don't know where do you find a full grid of female drivers who are good enough. Secondly, I've raced my whole career in motorsport as a normal competitor. Why would you ever look for a race where I was competing against women?
Because you're not very good against men. Sorry, like that's just the reality of the situation, really. But like, I know that's what Susie's quoted as saying, but in one element, she's absolutely right. Like, you're not going to get a full female grid. Because, simply put, and this is the biggest problem with the idea and the concept of an all-female racing series, there isn't enough women. Period.
But, I mean, it's almost ironic. This is the problem we're trying to solve.
Yeah, like I don't think anybody truly is that against the idea of an all-female series. I think the bigger issue is that I think we all automatically, as a culture of F1 fans, cape for the girl. Because I know a lot of people that are like very inspired and motivated by Susie Wolf, or, you know, was inspired by her, by Maria De Valota, rest in peace, who was, you know, a part of the old Mauritius setup before she tragically passed. And, you know, Simona is, you know, doing a brilliant job as an IndyCar driver, essentially, and, you know, has been around the circuits now for a few years, was an F1 development driver last year, you know, that favourite role. And now, we're now in the era of Carmen Jordan, who got a seat this year, which, you know, for better or worse, is a joke, essentially, for all intents and purposes. And you could plug all those women in, and you'd be at maybe five.
Yeah.
You're a quarter of the way there. Like, where do you go from there?
I mean, the thing is, with Susie, when it comes to politics in Formula One, when it comes to mass politics in Formula One, and it's even applicable to the real world, it isn't ideologically driven. It's not ideas-based. It's all personalities. If someone likes a person, they'll follow whatever they believe to the end of the world. So when this whole situation came out and Bernie said these things, they're like, okay, it's Bernie being Bernie. But when Susie said, no, this is not the right way forward, everyone got on that Susie Wolf bandwagon.
Because she's Susie Wolf. And for the most part, people like her. So, and you know what? She is a nice girl, so I can see why. But
it's like, I like her as well, but, I mean, there's incentive for Susie Wolf not to have the series.
Yeah, essentially. And you mentioned this before we went on the air with this podcast taping. Susie Wolf is the only woman in Formula One right now. That in itself is a well-selling novelty that would immediately go away if there was an all-female series in Formula One.
Yeah, it's like, it's like Pastor Maldonado's novelty, like the reason why he's sponsored by the Venezuelan government, because he's the only major international Venezuelan driver.
It kind of helps when there's no competition around you. Same with Susie Wolf, and you know, Susie Wolf's got good sponsorship. She's got a set of very unique sponsors that most drivers would die to have.
Yep, I mean, listed on her website, Willis Investment Group, I mean, Willis Insurance Group was the major international company. You also have UBS, which is one of the largest banks in the world, and you have Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah. Exactly. So, essentially, you know, Susie's got a lot to lose from endorsing an all-female series, because all the other girls around her would get top-level sponsors too, because marketing a girl opens up a lot of revenue streams that you wouldn't normally get if you were marketing a man. Let's be real here with each other.
Yeah, and it's like, to be honest, and with more and more, if there are more and more girls entering the ladder and eventually reach her level, her marketing value drops significantly.
Yeah, because, you know, even if there was one other girl who was decent enough to be in Formula 1, even as a development driver or as a reserve driver, and who was well-sponsored, unlike Simona, bless her, which, you know, if she did, that would have been very interesting indeed, how that one would have gone down. But if another woman rocks up with the same level of sponsorship, Susie's in big-ass trouble.
Yeah, I mean, Susie's in trouble. But the thing is that it almost seemed to Susie like if this series were going to happen, it would be tomorrow. And we all know that wouldn't be the case.
Of course not. Of course not. And that's an impossible realization. Like, any series like this would probably take a good couple of years to sort out properly, more than anything else. You can't just build a new Formula class overnight. Even Formula E took 3 years of development before it actually hit the grids. So,
well, I mean, Formula E is for other reasons, but just for any new series, it would take at least 1 year.
Exactly. Like, this isn't going to be an overnight thing, but you're absolutely right. I mean, your theory that you came out with before the show, talking about Susie and how, you know, it's in her best interests not to really endorse an all-female series despite the fact she's a girl. It's the old rational choice theory you came out with when it spoke about forcing you and letting Manor compete properly or not, or giving Manor a pass, essentially. Yeah, I'm sure it's all nice to wave the feminist flag and push for more women in F1 and more women in motorsport and whatnot. Guys, and this is my open message to you guys out here, because you know me, I come out with the vocal stuff, I come out with the hardcore, keeping it real shit right now. But essentially, people of the world, F1 fans, if you're one of those feminist F1 fans or F1 fans that are pushing for more women to be a part of the sport, don't endorse the F1 teams for basically going out of their way to endorse a woman that's only going to get in on PR and marketing like Carmen Jordan did. Try to get women to participate at the grassroots level, period. If you want a woman to eventually get into F1 on merit, you've got to start from the bottom up. You can't go from the top and hope for the best, because no F1 team is ever going to gamble on a girl when there's 50 male drivers that could easily go into that kind of role and, one, be better qualified, two, might be pay endorsed, and three, are probably better at driving anyway. Make it a long-term thing. Try and get more money and more female marketing money into grassroots motorsport, like karting and whatnot. You start that, that's half the battle, if you ask me.
Yeah, and one thing I just have to say is that I'm not being anti-Susie Wolf at all. Because, number one, these statements are not against what Susie Wolf has stood for at all. Where no. Susie Wolf has said, when the visor goes down, I'm just like anybody else. So why should Susie help her competitors?
Exactly, because you know what? These would be the women they'd eventually be competing with. And like I said, it's in Susie's best interests when it's all said and done to look after number one. And that means more to her bank balance and to her marketing power and her brand power as a Formula One developmental driver for Williams than an all-female feminist flying the flag F1 series, in my opinion. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for equality in Formula 1. I'm not against the concept of women in Formula 1 at all. I just want them to be in on merit more than the basic concept of marketing power and PR and hiring because she's a woman. And that's where I've got a problem.
So, Dre, do you think just the idea, just the general idea, no specifics yet, the idea of an all-female racing league would work?
Yes, because I think people would watch. I mean, if people watch women's boxing, people watch women's MMA because of people like Ronda Rousey. Like, I think there'd be a market for it. If people are willing to watch the lingerie football league, they'll watch women F1. Because, let's be real here, again, many guys feel like women in racing suits is sexy. I know it's being derogatory. I know I'm being derogatory to a degree saying this, but a lot of men will think like this. I guarantee you that.
But I mean, even when you take like sexual attraction out of this, people will still watch because, I mean, it was strange. One of the biggest sports stories in the U.S. yesterday was the fact that Abby Wambach was being traded.
Yeah, Abby Wambach, a female soccer player. I know America takes their female soccer very seriously in terms of, you know, they have some legitimate stars there. Like we've got like girls like Alex Morgan and back in the days of Mia Hamm and whatnot. And, you know, I know that America takes their women's soccer very, very seriously. And I get that, to be honest. I hope Sonna was like, you know, obviously a huge figure when it comes to American sport as well, and females in American sport in general. But, you know, if people cared about that, the fact that because we are in such a male-dominated sport, by default, an all-female series is going to draw a lot of attention, period. And if they could find a way to get a grid of maybe 16 to 20 decent female drivers, put it on TV, on a minor TV network, and market it, I think it would do all right.
Yeah, I think it would. But the problem is, to me, the fact that if there was an all-female series, it would be most effective at a level where it would be kind of difficult to get television coverage. Because in my mind, if there was an all-female series, it would be at the Formula 4 level. You know,
yeah,
the entry-level series from karting into single-seaters.
Yeah, that's a fair statement. That's a fair statement. You'd be talking Formula 4 level, basically. And I think a couple of female drivers would actually be overqualified for that kind of thing. Like Simona, she's better than being in a Formula 4 level series, obviously. Like, she's IndyCar, maybe even F1 level in terms of raw speed and in terms of ability. Like, Susie spent a bunch of time in Formula 1. You're trying to get in a Formula 4 car for the sake of it? I bet you she refused to go into that series if it ever actually became a thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. This series isn't for them because they already made it.
Yeah.
They're already at the top.
Exactly. This is for the people that haven't made it yet.
Yeah, because I don't know, a lot of people think Susie Wolf is the end-all be-all, but she's 32 years old. We have to think about the post-Wolf world.
Such thing exists? When Susie Wolf retires, it'll be the apocalypse. The four horsemen will rain down from the sky.
And this problem is going to go away the moment this series comes into place. In my mind, it's like, I have... If I were to run the single-seater commission like a Stefano Domenicali, it would be the current participation rate for women drivers in the direct feeders of Formula 1, GP2, GP3, Formula Renault 3.5, and the European Formula 3 Championship right now is at 2.3%, and that's insanely low. There are only 3 women drivers out of 128 drivers. And it's
where's your next F1 star going to come from then, really?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if I had a plan to get women drivers into Formula 1, it would be a 10-year plan. Number one, try to distribute scholarships for young girls to start karting in national karting championships.
That's an excellent idea. That's an excellent idea.
Number two, start up a European Women's Formula 4 Championship for those girls to move up into. And number three, the top three in the championship that year get a scholarship to move on to European Formula 3 and just see what happens within a decade. Just watch it play out.
And see what happens from there and just see if this is even a cause worth chasing, essentially. And let me know. Like I said, you've got to start from the bottom. You can't just plug in an untalented woman like Carden Jordan and, you know, get into a marketing role and hope by some miracle she ends up in a Formula One car, because that people are going to get pissed off by that shit. So,
yeah,
it's that's never going to be a thing. So you've got to start from the ground up, and it's going to take time more than anything else. And it doesn't help that the current crop on our headlining woman in Formula One representing this decade, Susie Wolf, is clearly looking after number one here, which she's got every right to do so. She's a smart woman for doing that. But to help the grand picture that all these F1 fans keep wanting to be keen on mentioning, Susie Wolf is not the answer. She never has been the answer, and she never will be the answer. So it's maybe time to stop listening to what she has to say on these matters, because she's not looking out for the grand picture. She's looking out for herself.
I said this before the broadcast started, that I compared this whole women driver situation to when baseball in America was segregated between basically black players than everyone else, because even Hispanics could play in the major leagues back then too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And it was a 26-year process that organized black baseball started in 1920, and by the time 1946 came around and they let Jackie Robinson play in the majors, by that time there were two major Negro leagues that rivaled the traditional major leagues that existed today, and it was a long process. It basically had to be to the point where the teams couldn't say no to black players because they were that good.
Exactly. And, you know, you'd be putting your own franchise at risk if you didn't take these kind of players and look like a fool that way, even if you take some negative PR for back in those days signing a black player. So, yeah, essentially, yeah, you're absolutely right. I thought that was a brilliant analogy when you first told me that, and I think it applies in exactly the same way here. Like, having an all-female series, I think, causes more problems than it solves, in my opinion. And, you know, I think it could easily go down the road of Foxy Boxing, so to an extent. And next thing you know, we're going to have a celebrity boxing special where Dikembe Mutombo gets knocked out or something.
I want to say it would be semantics at that point, because if they're racing, if they're not racing men, it's perfectly fine, but it's as long as they're racing in the same machinery as men, so they can get the experience, so they can move on to series where they can compete side by side.
Yeah, and like I said, I think we're all focusing our energies in the wrong spot, in the same way that we did that with Bernie Eccleston whenever he comes out with something meaningful. How's that for irony? And a way to close the show, really, more than anything else. So, great podcast. I've really enjoyed this one. Well, probably the most concise we've had to date, I'd say. I really enjoyed this one. King, what you got to plug, my man?
Plug? Well, the latest episode of my podcast came out, the Finish Line Podcast. You can check that out on my blog, formulae.nyc. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Ryan Eric King. And you can follow just for my blog post on formulae_NYC.
Yep, and obviously you can check that out as well. He has his own podcast, The Finish Line, on there, which is excellent. Him and Athlete VG. An episode could come out today, actually. So after you finish with us, go listen to them as well. Subscribe to the pair of us and whatnot. If you haven't already, you can check me out, obviously, at harris101.com. Everything to do with me is on there. From my blog posts to my podcast to my video work, you know that already, more than likely. You know my Twitter address, at Harrison101HD. You know where to find me where that's concerned. And you can also find me on Downforce Radio on every Friday night with Bike Live, and we'll have a lot to talk about where that's concerned. So you might want to tune into that one. It's live on Downforce Radio and on Spreaker at 8 p.m. on Friday night. That's 8 p.m. British Standard Time, obviously. Don't forget about the clocks and whatnot. So yeah, check that one out, and we'll be going over the entireties of Qatar in even more stunning detail and whatnot. There's going to be an awful lot for us to talk about on that one. And I get to take piss out of Rebecca James for 2 hours, so that in itself has to be worth listening to, right? Right? So, until then, from me, from Ryan, I hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and we'll catch you guys next time. Thank you very much for listening.